Welcome to The Wicket.
Hello and welcome to your regular portion of Cricketing Sustenance from Arab News here at The Wicket. I'm Brian Murgatroyd, and with me as ever to assess the latest happenings in the sport are Arab News columnist John Pike and Arab News cricket reporter Subhash Hamagain. Hello, gentlemen.
Hello, Brian. Hello, Subhash.
Hi, John. Hi, Brian.
And in this episode, we discuss the first seven matches of this year's Indian Premier League. There's three women's series ongoing, and we focus on them all. That's Australia in Bangladesh, England in New Zealand, and Papua New Guinea in Zimbabwe. We look back on a compelling first test of a two-match series between Bangladesh and Sri Lanka men in Sylhet. We review the African Games with double gold for Zimbabwe. We chat about Cricket South Africa's central contract announcements. We reflect upon a host of stories emerging out of Pakistan and their significance. And Subhash and John give us their personal highlights from the past week. So, as ever, plenty of subjects to discuss. So let's get cracking. We're recording this podcast after seven matches of this season's IPL, and already it's produced some terrific cricket. It all began with Chennai Super Kings beating Royal Challengers Bengaluru by 6 wickets in Chennai on the opening night. Chennai is the only side to have played 2-1-2 so far after beating the Gujarat Titans in match 7, a repeat of the final and the result in last year's IPL. There have also been wins for the Punjab Kings against Rishabh Pant's Delhi Capitals, Kolkata Knight Riders against Sunrisers Hyderabad, Rajasthan Royals beat Lucknow Super Giants, and Gujarat, they beat Mumbai Indians in the opening match for both teams. RCB have also won as well. They came from behind to beat Punjab Kings. As we record this episode, four sides, Mumbai, Delhi, Lucknow and Hyderabad, are yet to win, although all have played just the once. So let's review what we've seen so far. And John, for CSK in the tournament opener against RCB and in the match against Gujarat, it was very much business as usual, wasn't it? They're the defending champions. They've got a new captain in Rutaraj Gaikwad, but it's the same well-oiled machine.
Yes, so far, so good for them. The second match, Rachin Ravindra scored 46 out of 62 in an opening partnership in only 5 overs. Gaikwad anchored, Dubey smashed 50 off 23 against the spinners. And Rizvi, one of my players to watch, hit his first ball in the IPL for 6, and then his second. And after that, the quick bowlers, Chahar and Deshpande, reined in the Titans. And this was all after the first match against RCB when Mustafa Zur was the starter and was 4 for 29. So plenty of class and plenty of options there.
Absolutely. Well, Subhash, RCB may have lost that opening match, but they bounced back with victory over the Punjab Kings. And one of the stories for them so far has been the performances of the veteran Dinesh Kartik. He made 38 not out from 26 balls in that CSK defeat to give his side something to bowl at, and then 28 not out from 10 deliveries to mastermind a tricky chase against the Punjab Kings. He's impressed, hasn't he?
Yes, sir. He certainly has. I think he rolled back to the years in that Nidadas Trophy innings. I think it was pretty much the same condition that RCB needed, and he made sure that he did the job after Virat Kohli got out. I think he was looking in fantastic. It looked like he would get to the three-figure mark, but once he got out, Karthik made it look easier for RCB. So I think Karthik is going to be even better in coming days, and that I think this specific innings will show his reliance in the middle order for the RCB.
John, KKR's Andre Russell, Kolkata Knight Riders, he produced a blockbuster innings to take control of their match against Sunrisers Hyderabad with 64 not out from just 25 balls. It's good news for KKR that he's in this sort of form, as there aren't too many players in the world who can do this, are there?
But if you mean someone coming in at number 8 to rescue the innings, which had been sort of anchored that so far by Phil Salt's 54, there are a few of them. There are players with similar skills, but they bat a bit higher. We should note also this was a very close call for Cummins' team, losing by only 3 runs.
Subhash, one player who can explode like Russell, and John alluded to it there, is Heinrich Klassen, who matched Russell with 63 from 29 balls, and he took the Sunrisers from needing 60 in the final three overs to a position where they could and perhaps should have won that game. They needed six from four balls but couldn't get across the line. Perhaps we shouldn't be surprised, though, at Klassen's efforts after what he produced in last year's ICC Cricket World Cup and this year's SA20.
Yeah, I think there's internal competition as well. Klassen has been fantastic with the bat and he's just continued it here as well. And this internal competition, as I mentioned, you're having Glenn Phillips and Travis Head in the bench who have had a fantastic season as well. So he needed numbers, but he'd be gutted that he could not finish the game and take the team to the winning side. But he's shown what he can deliver. And I think the position for that top order batting and being the wicketkeeper, I think Klassen has cemented his place in this much competitive side.
Yes, that is competition, isn't it? With Glenn Phillips and Travis Head on the sidelines. Goodness me. Subhash, let's talk about Rajasthan's win against Lucknow. Sanju Samson, a player we mentioned in the previous podcast ahead of the IPL, he produced a superb innings of 82 not out from 52 balls for the Royals. Do you think he can force his way into India's T20 World Cup plans?
Well, the race is open. The wicketkeeper batter position is especially open because Jiti Sharma has been used. They may go with Rishabh Pant as well, but there's huge doubts over him keeping wickets as well. KL Rahul is there. Sanju Samson has been in and around the team, but he has not been able to cement that position when he got the chance in Indian team. So I think the IPL will have a big say in who goes and keep the wickets in the World Cup. So if Samson keeps his form, I think there won't be any doubts over who keeps the wicket, but he needs to get the runs in IPL.
John Sam Curran, another player who made runs in the first round of matches, 63 from 47 balls to help Punjab Kings down the Delhi Capitals. Do you think that after last season, when he had the millstone of a $2 million plus price tag around his neck and he struggled to live up to that billing, might we now see more of what he really can produce this season? After all, T20 World Cup selection is very much on the line.
No one hopes so, and certainly his franchise owners will hope so. I think sometimes players can try a bit too hard. I mean, he is capable of match-winning performances, but isn't really consistent enough. And Ing be very well aware that England's selection is on the line, as you say.
Subhash, let's talk about Hardik Pandya. His return to Ahmedabad with Mumbai Indians didn't go according to plan from his perspective, with a six-run loss. How on earth did Mumbai lose that game when they seemed to be cruising? Should it be a cause for concern, or can it be just dismissed as one of those things given the quality they have in their lineup?
I think this was the one they should have won with the history of not winning opening matches going long way. I think Hardik Pandya could have started well, and his captaincy role, there have been rumours, there's no not good signs in between the players in the dressing room. So this win would have motivated them, maybe had some good start, but still affect the team. The fans let their dissatisfaction know with booing Hardik Pandya. I think that's rare scene in Indian cricket as well. But Pandya should step up from here. And I think he had a chance to win the match as well. Tim David was a disappointment with the way he was playing in Australian colours. So I think this was one match that Mumbai could have won, but they do have resources to come back and I think get to the final at least.
As the caravan rolls on, we will, of course, stay across all the stories and we'll chat again about the second week of the tournament on our next episode. Australia's women world champions are in Bangladesh for a first ever bilateral one-day international series against the hosts and a first trip to the country in more than a decade. It comes at the end of an exhausting home summer that began way back on October the 1st with the start of a white ball series against the West Indies. Australia's plan with this tour is to use it as preparation for the T20 World Cup in Bangladesh later this year, while both sides are looking to use the one-day internationals to secure points in the ICC Women's Championship, the mechanism to determine direct qualification for the next ICC Women's Cricket World Cup in India in 2025. A reminder, in case you're not aware, the top five sides in the ladder plus India as hosts qualify for that World Cup. There are 10 sides in the ladder in total. The bottom four sides will go into a World Cup qualifier. Australia, perhaps unsurprisingly, are currently top, having lost only two of their 18 matches so far, while Bangladesh are seventh, but they've played more matches than any other team other than Pakistan, and so they look likely to be heading for that qualifier. Australia, they've steamrolled Bangladesh in all three matches. The home team bowled out for 95, 97 and 89 as the touring side won by 118 runs, 6 wickets and 8 wickets respectively. John, what else can we say? Australia truly are a winning machine, aren't they? Captain Alyssa Healy admitted before the first ball was bowled, some of the squad were very tired ahead of the series after a long summer and the Women's Premier League in India. And yet, they've still found a way of getting the job done, and not only getting the job done, but getting it done in ruthless fashion.
When I first saw that Australia scored only 213 in 50 overs, I thought tiredness must be a factor. And then you learn that the pitch favoured spin, and which is ironic in the light of BCB's policy to encourage faster pitches. But for Australia, the rescue act between Sutherland and King shows, like the men's team, they never know when they're beaten.
So, Bash, it's not all been bad news for Bangladesh, though, has it? As Nahida Akhtar's 2 wickets in the first one-day international made her Bangladesh's top wicket taker in the format. How do you view this series from the host's perspective? Is it demoralising or good to show their players and administrators what's needed to compete at the very top?
Well, they were in the game in the first match. They had Australia 48 for 4 in the first innings and chasing modest 200 odd runs. I think they started well, were 70 for 2 and could have gone anywhere, but I think they lost the momentum back then. And at their best, this has shown that they can challenge Australia as well. But this is a huge eye-opener on how good they need to be in order to play and challenge these teams. Also, the fact most players from Australia came from India with WPL, it made them a bit easier to settle in the subcontinent atmosphere. And in the first match, I think they might have been a bit tired as well. But once they set the tone, I think Bangladesh could not stop them and Australia were back in the champion song.
Well, after the One Day Internationals that now being completed, come 3 2020 Internationals. And we'll chat about those in our next episode. England's women are on tour in New Zealand for 5 2020 internationals and 3 one-day internationals, the latter part of the ICC Women's Championship. On our day of recording, England have clinched the T20I series, winning match 4 by 47 runs, with Maya Bouchier opening the innings and making a quick fire 91 from only 56 balls. That followed on from comfortable wins for England in the first 2 matches of the series, but then a horrendous collapse from the touring side in the third game that saw them lose after needing just 30 from 30 balls with 8 wickets in hand. John, England had their big guns back for match 4 with Alice Capsey, Sophie Eccleston, Danny Wyatt and Nat Siverbrunt all returning to the squad after the Women's Premier League duty. But obviously taking 4 key players like that out of any side is going to hurt it. But would you have wanted a bit more of a sign that England had strength in depth in the first 3 matches in their absence?
Oh, but that collapse shows why experience is needed. I think there was a bit too much inexperience on show. I'm sure they'll have learnt, but I think the newer players need to be gradually assimilated into the side. And of course, in that that match, they weren't helped by Sarah Glenn's concussion, which took her out of the play.
Sebash, by the same token, does it worry you that Sophie Devine with a 37 ball 60 and Susie Bates with a nerveless final over in that game 3 were the key contributors? We've spoken before on this podcast about the need for the next generation of New Zealand women to step up, and this seems to be another illustration of their reliance on the old guard, doesn't it? How worried should New Zealand be in a T20 World Cup year about their form ahead of that tournament, do you think?
Yes, there aren't players supporting them as needed, and that was just the case in the last matches as well. Individual brilliance will rarely win you matches, and now Devine facing race against time for the ODI series. I think the problem just increases. She said if it was for her, she would have batted in the second innings, but that's a promising sign, but still you would be worried with your main player facing race against. But the longer format is going to be even more tougher if others don't step up, and you can't always rely on these players.
Papua New Guinea's women are in Harare, Zimbabwe for 3 one-day internationals and 3 2020 internationals, series that are an end in themselves, but also part of Zimbabwe's preparations for the ICC T20 World Cup qualifier in the UAE starting next month. Zimbabwe won the first one-day international by 7 wickets, chasing down PNG's 177 with 11.1 overs in hand, as visiting captain Brenda Tau's 72 was trumped by half centuries from her opposite number, Mary Ann Masonda, and also Chipu Mageri Tiripanu, who's the wife of men's seam bowler Donald. That match was PNG's first ever women's one-day international, having been granted one-day international status in 2022. And in game two, Zimbabwe edged to a nervy 2-wicket win, chasing 126, as opening batter Modesta Mupa-Chikwa held the innings together with an unbeaten 57. Sri Lanka's women, they've arrived in South Africa and they're starting their tour of 3 2020 internationals and 3 one-day internationals as we record this podcast. We'll update you on the goings-on in that series in our next episode. Sri Lanka, they're also involved in that T20 World Cup qualifier, which will be played at 2 venues in Abu Dhabi, the Zayed Cricket Stadium and also the next door Tolerance Oval, which staged the Afghanistan Island Test match recently. The tournament is set to begin on April the 25th with a final on May the 7th, with not only Sri Lanka and Zimbabwe, but also Ireland, the Netherlands, Scotland, Thailand, Uganda, the UAE, the USA and Vanuatu taking part. Two sides will go forward to the T20 World Cup in Bangladesh. Sri Lanka's men crushed Bangladesh by 328 runs in the first of 2 tests between the sides in Sylhet. It could be argued that this was a test match that hinged on just one moment. Sri Lanka were 57 for 5 on the first morning when Mamadul Hassan Joy dropped Kamindu Mendis from the first ball the batter faced. Reprieved, he went on to make his maiden test 100, and with his captain Dhananjaya da Silva also reaching 3 figures, the pair added 202 to help Sri Lanka reach 280. The Sri Lanka seam bowlers then rushed out Bangladesh for 188 before another Sri Lanka collapse appeared to leave the test in the balance. But then back came Dhananjaya and Mendis for 2 more 100s and another substantial stand, this time 173, to take the game away from Bangladesh for good. Mendis and Dhananjaya became only the 3rd pair in history to produce 2 stands of 150 or more in the same test, along with Eddie Painter and Paul Gibb for England against South Africa in 1938, and Joe Burns and David Warner, who did it for Australia against New Zealand in 2015. Subhash, this was an unusual test in Bangladesh, wasn't it, as the faster bowlers ruled the roost? All 20 Bangladesh wickets fell to Sri Lanka seam and swing bowlers. Tony Hemming, the former ICC Academy curator, who was also in charge of the pitches at the Perth Stadium when that was first opened, is now working for the Bangladesh Cricket Board as a consultant. Are you content with pitches like this being produced in the subcontinent, or would you prefer to see the more traditional style of slow, low turners?
Well, I think the reliance on home conditions and more so using it as strength is slowly phasing out. The teams know they should perform overseas as well if they want to advance as a team, and which is why we've seen teams like India producing pitch-friendly pitches as well. Also, the talent they have in fast bowling pool, I think this is a good move from Bangladesh, like India did. And this also makes the matches more even, with the touring team getting to know these conditions and producing fantastic cricket matches.
John, what are your views on the attempts to make Bangladesh pitches a bit more livelier and friendlier for the fast bowlers? It needs joined-up thinking too, doesn't it, so that first-class cricket is played on similar pitches?
Well, the interesting policy line from the BCB was first expressed in relation to Bangladesh Premier League, when they quite blatantly said that T20 is a batsman's game and we aim for high-scoring matches. And they're looking to replicate pitches seen at ICC events, particularly in view of preparing for the upcoming T20 World Cup. And that message, that policy, was communicated to venue managers and curators. I mean, in red ball cricket, there's a different requirement, where good pitches provide an even balance between bat and ball, so that players of all styles, especially bowlers, have a part to play. In the Bangladesh captain, Shanto, said they got the pitch they wanted, but the team played badly. And of course, there was a drop catch. neither top order batted well for either side. So the standardisation of pitches doesn't nullify variations in human performance.
In terms of that test win for Sri Lanka, Dhananjaya in charge, his leadership at a very early stage of the Red Ball side, but doesn't appear to affect his batting, does it? 200s in the same match.
Well, he certainly seems to be a man for a crisis. On top of the observation you made about two 150 partnerships, is the first Sri Lankan captain to score 100 in each innings. And incredibly, you know, he and Mendes contributed 72% of the runs scored off the bat by Sri Lanka in the match. And it does look as if Sri Lanka are getting stronger across all formats.
Subhash, Kamindu Mendes, he played some fabulous shots through extra cover and was also happy to pull. Has a star been born here at test level for Sri Lanka, or should we reserve judgment until perhaps after the tour to England later this year?
Well, two centuries in same test is a rare achievement, and that too when top order had collapsed in both occasions. Started well, has impressed in recent limited overs cricket too, and that partnership with skipper was very important to bring Sri Lanka back into the game in both occasions. But I'd like to wait until the overseas tour, how we face in new condition and against comparatively tougher bowlers.
Well, the second test of this short series begins in Chattagram on Saturday, March the 30th. And if it's wrapped up by the time of our next podcast, then we'll be chatting about it here. The African Games have concluded in Accra in Ghana, and the event included cricket with eight teams, hosts Ghana, Kenya, Namibia, Nigeria, South Africa, Tanzania, Uganda and Zimbabwe taking part. It was a very significant event, especially for the men's teams, as some of the matches had official T20I status. And that was important because it meant the results in those matches impacted the ICC T20I team rankings. And that meant a great deal because those rankings represent a path to direct qualification for the 2026 ICC Men's T20 World Cup in India and Sri Lanka. There are 20 spots in that tournament, with eight going to the top eight sides in the upcoming event in the Caribbean and the USA. A further two will go to India and Sri Lanka as co-hosts if they don't finish in the top eight. Four spots will go to teams on the basis of their positions in the ICC rankings. The cutoff for those rankings is June the 30th this year, and with at least two of the sides in Accra hovering around the edge of the top 12, the results do have the potential to go a long way to ensuring those sides taking part don't have to go through qualifying in 2026. Zimbabwe beat Namibia in the men's final, easing to success by eight wickets with 31 balls in hand, while Uganda comfortably overcame Kenya by 106 runs in the third and fourth place playoffs. Most importantly of all, though, is that Namibia now sit in 11th place in the ICC rankings, while Zimbabwe are 13th, although only three rating points separate them, with Ireland sandwiched in between. In the women's event, Zimbabwe made it a golden double as they beat South Africa in a super over in the final, going through the whole tournament unbeaten. John, I mentioned in the preamble there that some of the matches had T20I status, and it turned out that all the matches involving South Africa and Zimbabwe's men's teams didn't. South Africa selected a squad full of university students, and Zimbabwe picked an under-25 squad. But strangely, this news didn't come out until after the event when, during the tournament, the myth was perpetuated that the matches were all T20Is. In fact, ESPN Crick Info listed all the South African players in their opening match as making their T20I debuts. Can we wonder, John, why this wasn't corrected at the time and why this was allowed to remain in the public domain until after the event?
Well, it certainly is a bit of a kerfuffle over retrospective change of status involving matches those weakened sides. It's I think it's still entirely clear whether all or some have been affected. Unravelling who did or said what looks to be the stuff of an Agatha Christie thriller, and it's a bit too complex. Here, and I'm going to try and delve more deeply into it in this week's column, but it does look as if there's a bit of collusion here between the organisers of the tournament, and the boards must have known that they have the status of the games, otherwise they wouldn't have sent a weakened side. They were probably pulled out of the tournament, which would have sat badly with the organisers and their desire to make it appeal to as many people as possible. So I think there's some skullduggery here, which hasn't fully been unravelled.
Well, we look forward to your column there, John, and any listeners who want to dive into that can do so at arabnews.com/cricket. Sebash, what were your impressions of the African Games tournament as a whole? Was it underwhelming, given those weakened sides on show in some cases, or a reason for positivity, perhaps, especially given women's teams as well as men's teams took part?
Well, had South Africa sent bigger names, it would have been a great spectacle. I think Associates of Africa could have rubbed the soldiers against the best. You don't have that in ICC Pathways or any other tournament getting to play South Africa. And these regional tournaments are should be taken as opportunity to let these associate teams grow and maybe face against the best. Overall, I think the tournament went competitive most of the times and showed that level of cricket is rising in this region. But both men's and women's game, I think we can expect better competition to teams like Namibia and Zimbabwe from these lower-ranked teams.
Who were your standout performers in the tournament? Who impressed you with their numbers?
Well, in no man, Modester Mupatsikwa, I think she had consistent tournament with runs in almost all the matches. Akelis Dlovu started the final and rightly got the best player with her impressive bowling. Similarly, in the main side, I think Zimbabwe will be happy with Owen's left-arm spin. He got 11 wickets and in that first win over Namibia, he was excellent with the bat too, so he might pave way to the senior side.
The new men's and women's central contracts have been released by Cricket South Africa. The players on the list in the men's section have been reduced from 20 to 18, and fast bowler Nandre Berger, currently at the IPL, and Tony de Zorzi have earned their first deals. But there's no place for Quinton de Kock, who's now retired from all but T20Is, and more surprisingly, fast bowler Anrich Nokia, who's at the IPL after an injury-ruined season that saw him miss out on the ICC Cricket World Cup. The women's list, that's increased from 15 to 16, with Shabnam Ismail dropping out after retiring from international cricket, while there's been no return for former captain Danny van Nieuwkerk, despite speculation in the media she may have returned to that list ahead of this year's T20 World Cup. John, no Nokia, that has to be a surprise, doesn't it? He may have been injured, but surely it's at times like this that you need to look after your assets by rewarding them with central contracts so you can keep an eye on them rather than sideline them in this way.
I think that's what they are doing. Apparently, he wants to focus on T20 cricket for the next few months, including internationals. So he's not retiring from South Africa T20 internationals. And towards the end of the year, he says he's looking to play ODIs again. And the CSA have said they're monitoring and helping him back to full fitness.
Sebash, are you surprised that Van Nieuwkerk hasn't returned among the women's list? Or is there still the need for a little bit of healing on both sides before that situation settles down following her controversial omission from last year's home T20 World Cup?
Well, I think this might be a statement from South Africa that she's no longer in the plans. She hasn't played for the side for 2 years now, a bit more, but at just 30 years of age, I think a lot of cricket waits ahead, from captaining the team to getting out of the team with injury and no comeback. I think the chances are getting slim now, and the no central contract could mean CSA have much ahead of her.
Well, there's never a dull moment in Pakistan cricket, and this week has been a case in point. Imad Wasim, the left-arm spinning all-rounder who was pivotal in helping Islamabad United win the latest edition of the Pakistan Super League, and Mohammad Amir, the left-arm fast bowler who's been playing for Quetta Gladiators, have both come out of international retirement for the upcoming T20 World Cup. Both have been included in a training camp, along with Usman Khan, who was one of the batting stars of the PSL and who's currently qualifying to play for the UAE. Also in that training camp, fast bowler Harris Rauf, who's been handed a new central contract after his old one was torn up by the PCB in the wake of his refusal to tour Australia with the test squad late last year. A new selection panel has also been constituted with four former test players, Wahab Riaz, Mohammed Yusuf, Abdul Razak and Asad Shafiq, plus the captain, coach and analyst. Talking of the captain, PCB chairman Mohsin Naqvi, in speaking with media, wouldn't confirm Shaheen Shah Afridi as the men's T20I captain, saying the new selectors would make that decision. And while Imad and Amir are back in the fold for the men's team, one of the women's team's leading lights for more than a decade, Javira Khan, has retired after 228 white ball matches, a run that started back in 2008. She's a former captain, but was passed over for a new central contract last year, and now she's decided to walk away, even though the T20 World Cup is just a matter of months ahead. Finally, Sharia Khan, the former Pakistan Cricket Board chairman, has died at the age of 89. He was in the role twice. The first time 2 decades ago, a period that coincided with the normalisation of relations with the Board of Control for Cricket in India. India toured Pakistan in both 2004 and 2006, and the two teams came together to play the first one day international at the Zayed Cricket Stadium in Abu Dhabi. All those things seem like a million miles away in the current day and age. So, a quiet week, you might say, in Pakistan cricket. John, a word first of all on Imad Wasim and Mohammad Amir out of international retirement. And I think certainly in the case of Imad, we were expecting that, weren't we?
Well, the story with him is that he was asked, unsurprisingly, given those PSL performances, to rescind his decision, and he agreed. Amir, of course, is a very special case. And you'll know that during his time with the Vipers at ILT20, he thought that after 3 years out, it would probably not be sensible to come back, adding for now at least, feeling that the boat had sailed. Well, that boat seems to have turned around and possibly have to dig deeper for the decision. The new chair, Mohsin Naqvi, founded a media group in 2009 and has only recently become interior minister. Interestingly, he was orphaned at a young age, so it's possible that this different background and personality creates a very different atmosphere for the players compared with what's come before.
Yes, Mohammad Amir, he's always left the door open to come back. He's never said never, and now here he is back in the fold for that World Cup in the Caribbean later this year. Sebash, what do you make of the situations around Usman Khan and Harris Rauf? Usman Khan, for all intents and purposes, all set to play for the UAE or qualifying to do that. Then he's had this stellar PSL, and lo and behold, the Pakistan Cricket Board have brought him back into the fold there. And Harris Rauf, well, it has to be good news for both player and board, doesn't it, really, after this long-running dispute between the two parties?
If I were in the panel, I think both would be on the plane donning Pakistan's green. Usman has proven how good of a player he is. Sultan split him in overseas court after all, and he's admitted he will let go of that UAE qualification if Pakistan come calling. And Harris, he was on demand in France's league and could be dangerous in that partnership with Shaheen and Nasim for Pakistan. So I think if board drops all sour notes with him and pick him, I think it will all be good for both the sides.
Sebash, also, what about Mohsin Naqvi's unwillingness to endorse Shaheen as captain? Do you read anything into that, or is he simply showing a degree of sense in not committing himself in either direction? If you were Shaheen, would you be worried?
Well, I told earlier when he was handed captaincy that there were better options for Pakistan. If I were Shaheen, I'd just focus on my bowling and not focus on the leadership side just yet. If you ask me, Mohammad Rizwan is best suited for the role at the moment. Shaheen, I think, is not ready to handle both bowling-wise and captaincy pressure at the same time. And this could be a blessing in disguise for him and both Pakistan if he's relieved of the role.
John, what about the newly constituted selection panel? Pakistan always needs to be representative across regions and disciplines to avoid accusations of bias. But this panel, is it too big, too unwieldy? 7 people in total. Or are you pleased to see plenty of representation from recently retired players who are in touch with the current game?
I think it might well turn out to be too big. The interesting thing is that there's no chair. The new head of the PCB has said they can discuss it amongst themselves without any involvement from him. He was keen to point out. I think it is good to see selectors with recent connections to the game. I mean, Wahab Riaz was chief selector in the dissolved committee, last played for Pakistan in December 20. Abdul Razak previously been a selector, last played in 2013. Shafiq's last test was in 2020, having even played a first-class match this year. And of course, Mohammed Yusuf was a supremely talented cricketer. He last played in 2010, making 23 centuries. So it's a fairly eclectic group.
Yes, and Mohammed Yusuf, he's been part of the coaching setup with the Pakistan men's team in the very recent past, so he'll have his finger on the pulse there. Subash, Javeera Khan, she's chosen an interesting time to step away, hasn't she? So close to the T20 World Cup in Bangladesh later this year. But was the writing on the wall when she wasn't in that latest central contract list last year?
Well, past few years had not been good for her form-wise. And as a senior player, when you don't have numbers, I think it's tough for selectors to back her up and let the youngsters go. She got that nod in the last World Cup and she couldn't get the numbers that as required. So only logical to call it a day and make the jobs easy for selectors, but what a servant she has been for Pakistan cricket, second highest run getter in limited over cricket, and this end certainly doesn't summarise her career after all.
Yes, she still made herself available for international leagues if she gets the call, so perhaps we haven't seen the last of Javeera Khan on the pitch. John, it's always possible to look at past eras with rose-tinted spectacles, but Sharia Khan's time as PCB chairman, especially his first stint, is one that is looked back on fondly. A professional diplomat, he was well suited to negotiating the issues around Indo-Pak relations. How they must wish for someone with his skills of persuasion now, as we seem further than ever from a resumption of bilateral ties between India and Pakistan, don't we?
That is for sure, especially with the 2025 Asia Cup looming on the horizon. A testimony to his two stints is that between them, the years between them, 2006 and 2014, there were years of turbulence. Sadly, began with the forfeiture of the Oval Test in 2006. He brought about transition and modernisation. T20, for example, which he wasn't keen on, but saw the potential. He brought in Bob Woolmer, foreign coach, lucrative broadcasting deal, central contracts. And I think if anybody wants to know more about this impressive figure, then I recommend you pick up his book, Cricket Cauldron, or a book written by his son, Ali, on cricket in Pakistan.
Yes, a very impressive man who I was fortunate enough to deal with on a regular basis in the past, and he'll be very much missed. And finally, gentlemen, as we always do, let's hear from you about something that's caught your attention this week in the world of cricket. John, first of all, what's tickled your fancy?
Well, several things. Apart from the shambles in Ghana, I was tickled by the fact that Wanindu Hasaranga hasn't yet managed to get a game in the IPL after all the shenanigans over retirement. He's injured. Ironic, indeed. But just to square the circle, I mentioned the final of the Sheffield Shield last week. Caught my eye again by virtue of the margin of victory. Western Australia winning by 377 runs, having been asked to bat by Tasmania. It also serves to illustrate the quality of talent coming through in Australian cricket.
Yes, mighty impressive from Western Australia. That's three Sheffield Shield titles in a row. And when you think they had a host of players missing from that final as well, it just goes to show what an excellent production line they are for Australian cricket. Subash, what's attracted your attention over the past week?
Well, the Ireland Wolves team were here in Nepal, and it was very surprising to see the team not performing at their best. But as Coach Eggleston said, that most of the players were not playing outdoor cricket for a long time, which is why they struggled getting into the game. But they still have series against Nepal, both in T20. So I expect a better competition to come on, and Nepalese team, they will be going to India as part of the preparation for the World Cup.
Yes, fascinating stuff. Good to see Ireland and Nepal try and get some preparation for both teams ahead of the T20 World Cup, and also trying to give some experience to players below the first team as well. That's all we've got for you this time here at The Wicket. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll be back soon with more cricket chat from the Gulf region, Asia and worldwide. Please don't forget to like, subscribe and comment on what you've heard wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love to hear your feedback, and let us know if there's anything you'd like us to feature in future episodes. For now, though, this is Brian Murgatroyd along with John Pike and Subash Hamagain saying thanks for listening, and we look forward to your company next time.